there's an anti other action for general volunteers, for free matters. Right, where this is the scalar curvature. Do you know any of this? I forget what you know, but you, we did general volunteers.
Yeah,
you all know
yeah.
That we did. Okay. All right. The problem is, this thing's not invariant under a global scale transformation. Okay. G mu nu gives you a length square. Right? So if you change your units, let's say, by a factor of L going to e to the lambda L. So if all lengths do that, the way to handle it in the field theory is for G mu nu to be replaced by e to the 2 lambda to the df squared times G mu nu. So that's a conformal transformation. And any transformation that changes the metric by an overall factor is considered a conformal transformation. If you want to find them all, one way to do it is to ask for all vector fields psi such that the lead dragging of the metric in the psi direction changes G by no more than a function. So you can find all of the conformal Killing fields, and you find the conformal transformations that we may or may not have talked about before. I don't know. These guys are certainly. Never mind that. Okay, we're just talking about a simple scaling. And if you do that here, root G, all right, G is the determinant of G mu nu. If we're in four dimensions, that's going to go to e to the 8 lambda times the determinant of the metric, because you've got four G's in the determinant. Four components of G, and each one changes by 2 lambda. Then the square root of that is going to change by either the 4 lambda. And that's just what you expect because it's length of the fourth integral you're doing. So you put it, you put the dimensions in the fields, not the coordinates. I know you know that it does. But you still come out with four factors of length for, you know, that's the volume element or this whole thing. So you've got the right dimensions for that. Curvature, on the other hand, the scalar curvature is an inverse metric on the Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor is a contraction of the Riemann curvature tensor. So, first and third contraction. And this, in turn, is built out of... Oh, this gets very hairy, doesn't it? Let's do it the ugly way. Alpha mu, alpha comma mu. Anti-symmetrize and whoops, not yet. Comma alpha. Plus gamma gamma term. I won't write all the indices on those, but the Riemann curvature tensor. This in turn is built out of gamma alpha mu nu is a half g alpha theta g theta mu comma nu minus g plus g theta nu comma mu minus g mu nu comma theta. And the dimensions of curvature, we can back figure it all out here, right? Here you've got a metric and an inverse metric, so those are going to cancel. The inverse metric is going to go like e to the minus 2 lambda. Right, it has to stay inverse to that. So it'll pick up the opposite factor. The product is 1 and it stays 1. So you don't get any factor from that, but the derivative gives you a 1 over length. So this should transform as 1 over length, and indeed it does. then the curvature is a derivative of gamma. So this is going to transform this 1 over length square. And if you check, the curvature has units of 1 over length square. For example, if you think of the Gaussian curvature of a two-dimensional surface, I think I talked through how it's the 1 over the product of the principal radii of curvature at each point.
The negative sign doesn't make a difference in that case? Don't you pick up a negative sign with the derivative?
1 over length. That's why it's 1 over instead. Yes, it's a power.
Why you don't. Okay.
Yeah.
I think I see.
So, let's see. Wait a minute. My abstinence issues. Sorry. I said one thing and I went off and did another. Okay, the coordinates don't have weight, so the derivatives aren't going to do anything. This is dimensionless. The thing that has dimension is the scalar curvature. So, yeah, we've got a G and a G inverse. The coordinates don't do anything. It's just the field. So the Riemann curvature tensor, with the indices in this position, that's important, has zero conformal weight in this sense. But when you form the Ricci scalar, right, you take one contraction to form the Ricci tensor. Now we take the trace of it. This brings in an e to the minus 2 lambda because it's the inverse. So the Ricci scalar goes with the 1 over length square, transforms with an inverse length square. Sorry, I got that back. Okay, so if you look at what happens to the action, this is going to go to, we get an e to the 4 lambda from the volume element. We get an e to the minus 2 lambda from the scalar curvature. Then we have root g e4x and the scalar curvature. So that's what happens under a change of units to the Einstein-Hilbert action. You pick up a factor of e to the 2 lambda. In particular, it is not invariant. So, let's try something else. Let's try a scalar field. If we have, let's just take a massless Klein-Gordon type scalar field, d nu phi. We could add a mass as well, but we don't need it to analyze the unit, right? The scaling property of the field. The easiest way to do it is to demand that the action is scale invariant. And since you've got, let's see, what do we have? We've got a volume element here. What's going to happen? Here we've got an e to the minus 2 lambda on the inverse matrix. Here we know we have e to the 4 lambda for the volume element. Then here, if we assume that phi goes to e to the n lambda phi for some n, what we want to do is find n. We can do that by demanding that the action be scale invariant. And so here we're going to get an e to the n lambda. Here we're going to get an e to the n lambda. So in order for s to go to s, we require e to the 2n minus 2 plus 4 lambda equal 1. Just adding all the factors. And that says that, let's see, n has to be minus 1. So we take phi goes to e to the minus lambda phi, assign a scalar field of weight of minus 1. If you were doing it with the coordinates, you'd come up with the same thing. You know, the derivatives would be 1 over L to the 4x to the, you know, plus 4. So you'd need a minus 1 on each of those to bring it to 0. So you can do it either way. You just have to keep track of which way you're doing it. In field theory, we want the fields to transform. So we do it that way. Okay, so here's what you can do to build a conformally invariant theory of gravity. We're headed for Dirac's large number hypothesis here. This is all fun. This is not exactly what I meant. Who knows? Somebody else might show up. Given time. You guys just find out. You're gonna take something. Is that right?
I'd like to, but yeah, have you talked to Carol Lee about putting something up there for me?
Let's see. What would it be? What do you want it to be?
Oh, just maybe. I've got more time this semester. Maybe do 2 credits instead of 1.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't know. How did we do it last semester? What did we call it?
It was just 3,500. I think you called it quantum field theory 1. So I think.
So we can probably just do the same thing.
That would be fine with me.
Yeah. I can tell.
So we could either do it as 1 or 2, as you wish.
Yeah. So, call it 2.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, we'll get into path integrals eventually here. Yeah, and if this is the group, we can probably move, a little faster than we did last semester. We didn't cover as much last semester as I usually have in field theory. I usually get to the point where we can at least do some, electron scattering, pair creation, some of those problems. And I think we're not all that far from it, but I'd like to just, move along and make steady headway in the book this time. I was teaching ENM for the first time in 10 years. I had to put a lot of attention to that.
Is it? I saw him around today.
The time worked out for him. This is a pretty good plot for me. This is good for you guys?
I have to leave by 4:20 because I've got to pick up people before.
Okay,
that's fine.
You want to stay later and talk some creatures and stuff. We do other stuff, but we don't have to do 2 hours, 3 days a week. So that's fine. Let me continue with the story because this is a kind of interesting one, and I think you all enjoy it. So what you can do, and what Dirac did, is added a scalar field in order to make this thing scale invariant. So in addition to the R, what would it take here? You need another -2. So if you put a pi squared in front of the R, you can make a version of general relativity that is coupled a little differently. And then you probably want to add in the usual stuff for phi. That's all fine. Let's see. I won't worry about the signs here. But you can stick in a Klein-Gordon type action, except it's coupled to curvature. Anyway, and this thing is now scale invariant. It depends what you do with math. Math goes like 1/length, and that'll work out. So it depends on whether you allow the math to scale or not. I scale the math. In field theory, they don't. In standard model field theory, there's a lot of talk about conformal invariance and how conformal invariance is broken. That's all applying to a different notion of what's being transformed and how. So it's important not to confuse those. There's a book by Britton and this guy was at Colorado. Maybe still at Colorado.
sorry, I'm blanking on the name now, but there's a nice book on conformal symmetry in physics, and in the beginning of this, he runs through about six different ways that conformal symmetry is used in physics, that is interpreted even. There are very different uses of the term. So it's important to know that we're dealing with one that couldn't possibly be broken. Naive dimensional balancing of units. So, one way to keep this clear is to look at the quantum corrections that people always talk about as being the ones that break conformal invariance of the theory. And, there are always something in the form log of, say, p squared over m squared. There's this sort of thing where, of course, that ratio is dimensionless, right? So if the mass is scaling, you're still talking about something that has a scale invariance, which we can easily gauge. So that term does not break the conformal symmetry that we're talking about. This coupling changes the gravity a little bit. The way Dirac thought of it was as what usually goes there is something like, maybe 1 over 4 pi times the gravitational constant. Something like that is what usually goes in front of R. He thought of it as a time-dependent gravitational constant. And then if you look at the equation you get for phi and give it a very slow time dependence, what you can do is link the gravitational constant to the age of the universe. And Dirac had this idea that numbers that are really, really large or really, really small are peculiar, and there must be a physical, dynamical reason for them to have really large or really small values. And so he wanted to try to couple them to the age of the universe, which is also a big number. This is called the large number hypothesis. And I don't know that it's actually been experimentally tested for sure. It changes enough things in the picture that you've got to just go back and figure out everything. But it's a neat idea. We can look at the field equations or something like this. Let's just vary this and see what happens. So if we find the field equation for phi, what are we going to have? We'll have our root b sitting out there. And then 2 pi delta r minus 2 whistle. We might as well stick a half here, then we can get rid of the 2. Then this is going to be minus plus phi del phi. You very well can get two of them, you integrate by parts, and you get a minus sign. Plus or minus m squared phi del phi. So the coefficient of del phi should be 0, so we're going to have something like box phi, minus r phi. And we could have an m term, I think, supposed to come in with with a minus m squared phi equals 0. So you get Klein-Gordon in this kind of R coupling that we're seeing when you square the Dirac equation in pure space. So the action that gives rise to the square of the Dirac equation is something like the one Dirac got from the large number hypothesis. And we need to do some literature searching. I've been reading a few things and found some things that you're going to find interesting too. There's this nice one that might be good to read for this class. Woodard, I think his name is, works in geometric quantization, which is a phase-based quantization. And he's written a sort of a review article trying to assess what we really know about quantum gravity. So it's from a particular perspective. I looked at his long list of references, and there are some important quantum gravity references that aren't in there. Like, he doesn't have Harlan Hawking, for example, who used a path integral approach. He's thinking of certain approaches in certain schools. But still, I think it'll be a sort of useful thing to read. It talks about the sort of conversions. I think we ought to do this in the next little while, since we're going to be starting perturbation theory in quantum field theory. The perturbation theory used in quantum field theory is not conversion. And that's really distressing. And he argues why that's okay except for QCD. It's going to be okay for gravity. It's spectacularly okay for gravity because the coupling is so weak. It works extremely well for QED. QCD, you know, this is why they go to lattice calculations on computers, because the perturbation theory from that integral is just not convergent enough. You can't really get much information out that way. Okay, let's see. So, this is neat because I forget what we talked about at this last time. But if you take the Dirac equation, I think I was mentioning this toward the end as I was thinking about it, but if you write the Dirac equation, you've got d slash psi, or d slash minus m psi. The action, you have a psi bar here. So there's the Dirac action, which we quantize and all that good stuff. But if you look at the same thing in curved space, what you want is, what you have are gamma matrices defined in the usual way. You have gamma A, gamma B is minus twice eta AB using my sine convention. And that defines your Clifford algebra. Well, you know, this is flat space, and you might like that to be a gene you knew now. What you can do is introduce an inverse solder form here, so you can use the flat space gammas, and if you put one of these on each, it'll turn that into the gene you knew. So that lets you then contract with a covariant derivative instead of the partial derivative. You now go to a covariant derivative, and you can stick in the math like you did before. And now this all works just fine as a curved space, or even a Dirac equation in general coordinates. That would be fine. And this, of course, is time the usual volume element, something like this. Okay. Now,
Can you repeat that last line? Because that was a lot. Where did the derivative come in?
Okay. Suppose we try to write this equation either in an arbitrary coordinate system where you don't want just partial, you need a covariant derivative, or even in curved space where, again, you need a covariant derivative using gamma, right? Okay? So you can just do that. I mean, the standard prescription for going from a flat space expression to a curved space expression for any sort of field theory, particle theory, is to replace all the derivatives by covariant derivatives. And the contractions by the metric and the volume element get the root g.
Okay.
So if you put in the root g here, in case you're not in Cartesian coordinates, you need that anyway for the volume element. But in a curved space, you need it. It's either curved space or spherical coordinates. You're going to need this in addition to the d4 action.
And that's all it takes to make something that will be invariant under general coordinate transformation and allows you to ask what fields do in a curved space-time. So it accomplishes both at once.
Did I answer your question?
I think so, but the solder form appearance was a little confusing to me.
Maybe. Oh,
I need to practice with that.
Let's just look at that. Right, the solder form relates the metric in general coordinates to the metric in orthonormal coordinates. So what you do is you choose instead of using coordinate differentials as a basis for covectors, you use orthonormal forms. So the inner product of these is the inverse Minkowski metric. And these can be written, since each of these has to span the cotangent space, the space of covariant vectors as a basis, they have to be linear combinations of one another, and the matrix that relates them is a, you know, this is called the solder form, and that those are components. But since they have one index of each type, you know, that's the matrix that relates coordinate bases and orthonormal bases, and inverse does the same for vectors. So here we've got an orthonormal vector index. We would like it to be an orthonormal coordinate index. So if I use an inverse solder form, which I write with the A down and the mu up, right? So the mu A, E, A mu is Kronecker. Those are inverse matrices. Then put a gamma A here, and I have an E, the mu, gamma B there. That's going to be equal to minus twice E. We just get those factors, E, A, U, E, B, nu, minus 2, and the eta, A, B. And that is minus twice E, nu. So now we've got some gammas. We could call that gamma mu, like this. And now we have some curved space gammas, built out of the flat space gamma. There's a paper that does this by Drill and Wheeler, looking at neutrinos. This was back in like the 50s, if you want to read about. You know, that they did it in both, in terms of both the orthonormal and the Greek ones, you know, because it wasn't, you know, they wanted to be sure that it was the same both ways. It wasn't obvious at that point. And their direct equation is massless, but, you know, they probably realized this even then. Yeah, Juan, you'll want to have a look at that paper.
Okay,
all right. I'll try to remember to send it to you. If okay. I don't send it to you, you know, the next day or so, send me a reminder and I'll send it to you. I'm pretty sure I've downloaded it.
Okay.
Yeah, does that help?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Other questions? Let's see. What were we doing? So, what I was starting to tell you here is now, you want to play the same tricks that we played before.
This other board is fine.
You know, it's. Seems like it ought to be the case that you can still square the Dirac equation and get the Klein-Gordon equation, but that's not quite what happened. If I take this, all right, let's say E A mu D mu gamma A. Let's call that just big D slash for conciseness. So our Dirac equation is now big D slash minus M by 0. And I can write that as d slash psi equals m psi. And I can apply d slash twice to this. So if I take d slash, compression of notation nice, that m is constant, so I just get a d slash of psi over here, but d slash of psi is just another m times psi. So this ought to be some second order wave equation that psi satisfies. Dirac got the Dirac equation by insisting that this should be the Klein-Gordon equation because he had a partial here. Well, let's see what this thing is. If I take d slash, that's really, let me also write this as gamma mu d mu, since I defined it for you there. So what we have is gamma mu d mu, gamma nu d nu. And the nice thing about the solder form, the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. And E is the square root of the metric in some sense, so the covariant derivative of E is zero as well. So there is an E in here, but it commutes with that D. So I can pull it out this way, gamma nu, d mu, d nu. And now I've got the product of these two gamma matrices and two covariant derivatives. Well, remember what happened before. We had two partial derivatives here. They commute, so it symmetrized this product. And we said, ah, symmetric product of these gammas, the anti-commutator of these gammas, has to be the metric. Well, now, these don't commute, so we can't impose symmetry on this. So what happens, you can write it by adding and subtracting these in the other direction. I can write this as half gamma mu plus gamma mu, where I'm adding a half of this. And then as here's the other half of the original gamma nu. So those two terms give that. And then minus, and then these two cancel. So it's a sum of the anti-commutator and the commutator, d mu, d nu. Now, this is the metric, or actually minus g mu nu. Alright, we get a 2, the 2 cancels a half. So this is the usual anti-commutator that we have over here. Boom, it's the metric. This is, if you recall, a definition, where do I put this? I'll just write it here. We define sigma mu nu, I guess it's okay with the Greek indices, to be, it turns out that 1/8 is a convenience thing, but these guys are the generators of the Lorentz group. They're these with the A's on there. The commutators of these give the Lie algebra of the Lorentz group. We've seen that several times. That's the whole covering group thing with generation. So that's what we get here, times 4. So let's call this 4 times sigma mu nu. Well, we know those sigma mu nu can't possibly vanish. They're the generators of the Lorentz group. So they're real, they're there, and we've got to deal with them. So now, we've got that d mu, d nu. Okay. Then what? The Ricci identity in general relativity is the commutator of two covariant derivatives. Since this is anti-symmetric, sigma mu nu, d mu, d nu, can be written as that's anti-symmetric, so I can induce the anti-symmetry on the C this time, sigma mu nu, commutator of two covariant derivatives. And the Ricci identity, so far, the Ricci identity, if we ask what two covariant derivatives acting on a vector give us, Have we done this? Should I work it out or just write the answer? I know you want to see it.
Sure.
How about you guys? Are you bored with that or you want to work it out?
Okay, yeah.
If it's something that you want to do. Okay. So I switch to the last one. Yeah, we're supposed to be sharp. okay, this is not too hard to do. We want V mu of, alright, this is V mu V alpha plus V beta gamma alpha. Just covariance derivative, right? And then I'm going to subtract the same thing with mu and nu interchange. Okay, so now I need, this is a rank 2 tensor, right? There are 2 free indices, so I'm going to need 2 gammas. But I take d mu of this thing, d mu, d alpha plus d beta, gamma, alpha, beta, nu. That'll have a bunch of parts. And then I need, for the up free index, I need a plus, and I'll need d mu, d, let's say, rho plus d beta, gamma, rho, beta, nu, gamma, alpha, rho, mu. Then for the down index, free index, I need a minus sign, and we have d, call it rho again, d alpha plus d beta, gamma, alpha, beta, nu, which for the nu becomes a rho, and I need a gamma, rho, nu, mu. And now I have to subtract the same thing with mu and nu interchange. That's the constant. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Covariant derivative. You remember the covariant derivative? Right? This is what big D means.
Yeah, that looks good.
Okay. I'm just doing it again. Right? Every free index of whatever I'm differentiating gets a gamma.
Okay.
Right? So here I'm correcting that free nu index with a rho up and a nu down and a minus sign. Here I'm correcting the alpha, in both cases, sum down with the alpha up and a plus sign. So just the rules for using the Christoffel connection on tensors. Okay, well, when I do this, everything symmetric is going to just drop out. And there's a bunch of symmetric stuff in all this. So, but let me write it out a little further, and then we can find what the symmetric stuff is. So one more step here. I've got d mu, d nu, d alpha. That's symmetric. That's going to go away. Then I have d mu, d beta, gamma, alpha, beta, nu, plus d beta, d mu, gamma, alpha, beta, nu. Very long gamma. D nu, d rho, gamma, alpha, rho, mu, plus d beta, I'm just distributing. Rho, beta, nu, gamma, alpha, rho, mu, minus d rho, d alpha, gamma, rho, nu, mu, minus d beta, gamma, alpha, beta, rho, gamma, rho, mu, 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 minus mu, nu interchange. Now, clearly this is going to go away. That's symmetric in mu, nu. So when I subtract the same thing with mu, nu interchange, boom, it's gone. Here, also, these terms, right, gamma is symmetric in those 2 lower indices.
Right.
So when I subtract that with those interchanges, that term goes away and that term goes away. Don't have to worry about it. Now, there are 2 more terms that also go away. Have to look a little bit closer, but notice these 2 right here. The 2 of them together are symmetric under mu nu interchange. They're the same term with mu nu interchange.
Right.
And a plus sign between. So when I subtract the same 2 terms, with mu nu interchange, the subtraction of this with me a new interchange will cancel that one, and vice versa. So those guys are going to drop out. So what we're going to be left with is these two terms minus the mu new interchange. Continuing. D mu, D mu on D alpha is equal to, what do we have left? There's this one, D beta gamma alpha, D mu gamma alpha beta mu. Minus the same thing with mu and nu interchange. Then we have this term, d beta gamma rho beta nu gamma alpha rho mu minus the same thing with mu and nu interchange. And that's just D contracted into the Riemann curvature tensor. That curl of gamma plus the gamma-gamma term. This is the way I always derive that expression. It's the easiest way to remember what it is, you know, which indices go where. This gives you a nice clean form for the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of the Christoffel connection. This is exactly d beta r alpha beta mu. So this is called the Ricci identity. It's a really useful thing. So now we have to do it again with spinners. Because with spinners, what you do, notice that this is acting on a representation of the group. The general coordinate transformations act on that vector space. It's a group acting on a vector space. So this is fine for a vector representation of the Lorentz group, gauging a vector representation. But we want a spinner representation. So to find the Ricci identity for a spinner representation, we need to know what the covariant derivative of a spinner is. Well, we know that. That's what the spin connection is used for. And let's sort that out. I guess I didn't tell you back here exactly what that big D did to that spinner. But remember, the spinner is this four-component thing. So we have to worry about that. So we need to know what the covariant derivative of psi is. Right. This is still a covariant derivative acting on a this time a complex vector. Now let me think how we know what it is. I know the answer, I'm just trying to see if I can think of a way to really divide it from first principles. So let me write the answer and see if anything occurs to it. Surely one place to start is by taking the partial derivative. And we know we have what's called the spin connection. And the spin connection is called that because it's the connection you use for spinners. All right. Well, we know we have this omega AB. Let me write it so the index order is clear. This is a Lie algebra valued 1 point. AB mu, right? There's a dx mu sitting there. Or we can use it on a normal basis just as well. Either one's fine. Right. A Lie algebra valued 1 form is a connection. Now, in what sense is this thing Lie algebra valued? The AB indices here are labels, the same labels we use in the Lie algebra. The Lie algebra is made up of generators. What are they? The sigmas. There's these commutators of gammas here. And so to see how this generator acts on a spinner, you need each sigma AB is a matrix that acts on some vector space. The vector space it acts on is the space of these spinners. So the capital A and capital B indices are spinner indices. This thing likes to act on the components of spinners to give transformed spinners. So differentiating a spinner, you need those guys. So if we make omega Lie algebra valued by writing omega AB sigma BA, you just subtract those together. If we were going to exponentiate, you'd want to have, but for the covariant derivative, we just do it this way. And now, this object, but because this is a matrix acting on the spinner space, this whole thing now is some linear combination of those. So that thing is a connection that knows how to act on spinners. And we'll give we'll know how to transform. The difference between this connection and gamma is that gamma corrects the derivative when you do general coordinate transformations. You can do a general coordinate transformation of a vector V alpha, and this gamma will subtract off the junk that comes from differentiating that transformation. For the spin connection, transforms under local Lorentz transformations. So a different Lorentz transformation at each point instead of a general coordinate transformation. They're almost the same. All right, a general coordinate transformation at a point is just a matrix. It's a general linear transformation. So this derivative is covariant under local general linear transformations. The diffeomorphism group, if you want to impress people. but local general linear transformations. This is covariant under local Lorentz transformations. All right. It's just the anti-symmetric part. Well, the two give the same geometry. Knowing all orthonormal frames is just as good as knowing all coordinate frames. Right? You haven't lost any information by restricting your attention to the orthonormal frames, and that restricts you down to an orthogonal group for the local symmetry or pseudo-orthogonal Lorentz. But no problem. You've still got all the same information. And we need to know how to differentiate spinners. So now we build our covariant derivative out of this guy. And what we do, if I call this thing omega AB and suppress the indices, I can just write, let's not suppress the indices. Let's just put one on here. So we'll have an omega AB mu. Because remember, it's still a one form. There's a one form buried in here. Fine. So that's our covariant derivative for spinners. How are we doing? Everybody happy? Great. Happy. That's the case. It'll last for a week. I don't know how long. Yeah, you good?
Yep.
Okay. Now, we want to find the Ricci identity in terms of this thing.
If we were to actually put like the bases, it'll be an exterior drifter, right? Covariant exterior drifter, right?
Yeah.
Right.
I can write this, you know, if I put a DX mu on this,
right, and everything.
I'm gonna get bold D phi equals straight bold D little D phi plus omega phi. Right, that's maximally codified. Right, but those are the same thing. You know, you just get tired of writing all the indices, but you've got to be able to put them back if you have to. There are a lot of indices in this, like, man. You know, we're dealing with a lot of different spaces here. You know, there's the space-time, and there's the three different spaces going on at once.
The capital Latin is the component of the spinner.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. 2 to the dimension over 2, depending what dimension you're working in. Okay. So we want to square this thing. I'm going to use the simple one. Use the form. We'll see if we can't get that to follow through right. We may have to stick in some indices halfway, but let's just see what happens. So the Ricci identity is the covariant exterior derivative squared. Because that's the commutator, right? That's equal to half the commutator of two covariant derivatives, because the dx is automatically anti-symmetrized. Just notice, this means dx mu d mu wedge dx mu d mu acting on phi, and I can write that as a half dx mu wedge dx mu d mu d mu commutator. So we're, you know, it's a very tidy little way to write the commutator. You got a factor of a half, who cares? You know, that's just a normalization. So let's see, what happens when we work that out? Let's leave it in terms of the form. This is easier to work with. So let's see what happens. Sometimes you pick up signs depending on which side you put the omegas on. I'm going to press ahead here and hope it works right. But we can figure that out if we need to. Omega phi plus omega. This is going to be right. D phi plus omega phi. If I was writing the omega on the other side of the phi, I'd pick up a funny sign. But this is okay. Little d squared, Joe?
What is it? What's that?
What's little d squared?
0.
You got it. So that one goes away. Then here we have two terms, d omega phi, and then d passing a 1 form gives a minus sign, omega d phi. So that's a 1 form. Then here we have omega d phi, and we have omega wedge omega acting on phi. Well, those cancel very nicely, and the sign's wrong. What's wrong with the sign here?
Is
It's going to be in the indices. All right. This almost looks like the right thing, but we've hidden too much. Right? You like a minus sign there, and then that's the usual expression. Remember the structure equation. D omega is omega, you know, right? A, B is C, D wedge omega A, C plus Riemann curvature 2 form RAB. Right, this is the structure equation for after we gauge the longer acres. So you'd like a minus sign here, but remember there's still sigma sitting in here. So we've got to worry about the sigma. So we have a question about the sign, but we still have sigma. So let's write this out carefully. D omega plus omega wedge omega is really D of omega AB sigma BA. These are constants, so the D is acting on these coefficients here. So we need to get it in that form with those indices showing. Okay. So here we have omega A B sigma B A wedge omega C D. Sigma D C. And we pull out the coefficient, and we're going to get a commutator of these guys. So we have G omega AB sigma BA plus omega AB wedge omega CD. And I'm going to put a half here and a commutator to sigma BA with sigma DC. Okay, so satisfy the Lorentz-Lie algebra. Mm-hmm. So we know what those commutators are, if we can remember which sign factors we have. So I'm going to try and just do that for you. Everybody with me?
Oh, that last term is... how did you turn that into the commutator?
These are one form. This is anti-symmetric. So I'm inducing the anti-symmetry over here with a factor of a half. You know, it's just like we did it before with the D's. It's exactly this step here, except that there are more indices, but the anti-symmetry is still working between them.
Okay.
The only puzzling thing is this has two indices and that two, but still, I'm anti-symmetrizing the AB with the CD. So
okay, I see that.
Okay. It's the same thing. If you do some index shuffling, you can prove that in real detail. That'd be a good exercise. Okay, we've got a curvature here. That's the old one. This seems to have turned into our seminar rather than our field theory class. I guess that's okay. You guys good with it? Okay. So, if I put all the indices in the same, suppose I raise the AC, so we have BA and DC. That's the same as, I want to get these in a form that I... These are anti-symmetric, so this is the same as sigma AB, sigma CD. If I flip both, I get two sines. And,
right.
Am I on your way here?
Right, yes, right. It's okay.
Okay. This, I'm pretty sure, is minus 1/2. Then I get the inside indices, A of B, C, with a sigma AD, and now anti-symmetrized. That's how I remembered. I could be off by, if we come out off by a sign, then I shouldn't have a sign here. I'm not sure whether the conventions I set up in those appendices end up giving you a minus sign here or not.
I bet it worked out so far.
it's the sort of thing we can check. So, okay. Anti-symmetrizing on AB, sigma DD, or on CD, DD, sigma AC, and anti-symmetrizing both AB and CD, we get two minus signs for a plus, so we have eta AD sigma BC. So it's that, my only uncertainty in my own mind is that overall sign depends on convention. But now, if I lower A and lower C again, just put Minkowski metric everywhere, I can just drop the AC over here, we have minus a half. This will be a delta BC. If I drop the A, those are in the wrong order. So let me flip them, get a minus sign, and write it as sigma DA, like that. Then this one, they both go down, eta AC, sigma BC. This one, they both go down over there, so eta BC, sigma AC. And finally, delta DA, and drop the C, I get a sigma BC, like that. Now I want to substitute that in here. Well, what I really want to do is put a couple of omegas onto that thing. So I have 1/2 omega AB with omega, omega CD, that's right. CD, then I'm going to have another minus a half from this. Oh, I'm sorry, wait. I want that with this. Let me write out what I want to make it an equation. Sigma DC. So I want to know what this thing is. I'm going to have minus 1/4 from the overall coefficient. And then I've got my omegas. And then a whole bunch of sigma eta stuff. Okay, so whatever's in here, minus delta BC, sigma DA, minus eta AC, sigma BD, minus eta BD, sigma AC, plus delta DA, sigma BC, equals minus 1/4. Now I want to bring these omegas in and see what all we get here. First term, delta BC sums these two, that's okay. So we get omega AC, omega CD, with that minus sign. Here, no, I think we're okay. Then eta AC, I could lower that and call it a C.
So you're missing your sigma. What happened to the sigma?
Oh, sigma DA. Okay, then I minus, let's just write C, D, omega, C, D, sigma DD. We'll have to do some rearrangement here. These, all four of these get the same thing and cancel that four. And rearrangement here gets rid of one sign and we're coming out right. So this is looking like the right thing. We just have to fuss with these images. So A to CD, I'm just raise that. So we have omega A D omega C D sigma A D down. And finally, plus D A, so omega A D omega C A sigma D. Yeah, that's it. Okay, this one already looks just right. I want to claim these are all the same thing, but let's do some rearrangement. Okay, this one, I want to interchange these two, and it'll make it look just like the last one. Let's just do things one at a time here.
These are whites.
These are still one more.
Okay.
Sigma D A. So my sigma is up left and down right. My sum is up left down right. That's the way we usually write it. So the down index is here. Sums with the up with the down. So that would be standard form. That would be just what we want. And it does have the minus sign. So we're good here. We just have to see that all four of these come out to the same thing. Way of checking our work. Let's see, if I put that D down, that doesn't cost me anything. That puts this D up. Then, what do I want here? Let's see. I may want to flip the. That might be better. Maybe a couple steps. Let's just do it up here. I have minus omega CD sigma BD. All right, that has... You can't scratch your hand with this. Let's treat that as the first one. Omega CD. So we get rid of one sign, sigma D. Now, this one, I want to flip those two. Omega CD, I get a minus omega BC, sigma BD. That minus omega CD. Now I want to raise the B, B, C, and lower the B here, B, what happened?
Was that
an A? Wrong.
I think that second omega is an AB, not a CB.
Where did we lose it?
You have an A over here. You left an A to B.
You lost the A in the second step.
So where?
The second omega in the second step.
Here?
Down. One below. Right there.
Should be
A.
B-A.
Yeah, but you put
there
a B.
There aren't any A's anywhere. Where are you getting an A?
Oh, just saying.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
I was
not
an A.
So, second A.
That's a D.
It looks like you have A, B on the second one. Instead of B, B.
So I've got two B's here. So I'm wrong. Where did I go wrong? This should have been a B, D. B, D. Sigma, B, D. Up. This was the one we were doing, right? That D should have been up.
Okay.
Now we're all right. Okay, so I lowered.
At the end of big tail.
This is backwards. I want to interchange those and get a sign. So this will be plus CD with omega BC contracted on sigma DB. I could have left a sign in here so before I write it. This is the proper way to have done that. So that becomes a plus, same thing as this. And I'm just going to claim I'm going to get times 4 here. This one's already good. Let's check this one. So we have minus omega AB, which omega CB contracted with sigma sub AZ. And let's see what's going to work here. I want to flip those two and raise and lower to A. So I'm going to have plus BA, which omega CB contracted on sigma AC. Then I lower the A here, raise the A there, no sign change. BA omega CB sigma AC. Everything's in the correct order, has the correct signs, correct sounds. So, the force. Question? And so what we get is minus omega CD wedge omega AC sigma DA. And so we finish up over here. We get D omega AB minus the half I put in. So there's no half. Then we have omega, all right, the sum of BA here, so we want AB, instead of AD, we need AB. So it's going to be CD wedge omega AC quantity sigma D, from BA. And this is the Riemann curvature 2 form with a sigma. In that three. And that sigma, like, this, think back to when I told you that the first two indices on the Riemann curvature are group action, and the last two are two form, the two dimensional plaquette, right? So here, right, the AB, you're explicitly seeing that AB depends on the representation of the Lorentz group. In this case, we've got a spinner representation, so that AB really contracts on a generator of the Lorentz group. And so the first two indices are the group representation indices, the last two are the plane. Hidden here, because it's a two form.
Okay.
I'll work out this right. In that field. So, Ricci identity, finally, d squared phi is RAB sigma BA. Fine, of how to act on phi. Now, let's see. This is a sine calculation from something else. So, we have to remember what we were doing.
Pair the gammas.
Let's see. We were squaring the Dirac operator, and we needed to know what we needed the Ricci identity to do that. So let's recall where we were. So we had d slash phi equal to. I think it was
Symmetric and symmetric part.
D mu nu.
And then the D.
Plus four sigma mu nu on the d mu acting on phi. I think that's what we had.
Yep.
So the first one is minus box. That's the covariant box now of fine. So just an ordinary box. This 4 sigma mu nu, okay, that becomes 2 sigma mu nu times, or in an orthonormal, let me do it in an orthonormal basis, the commutator dA acting on psi. And we just showed, what did we decide it was? Let's see, if we were to put the indices into this, what would it be? So we have d squared phi. We can write that as, in the orthonormal basis, as ea da wedge ev dz psi. That's 1/2 ea wedge ev commutator da dz phi. So it's this commutator we need. On the other side, we can write this as a two form. Let me change the names of the indices. This is d squared I'm writing, so I just can write equal to this. I'm going to write this as r cd sigma ba. Sigma. That would be truly weird. Sigma d c phi, but I'm going to put the a b e a wedge e b with our conventional 1/2, expanding it in the basis as a two form. The halves and the e's are just basis. We can cancel that and identify the commutator d a with d b on phi with r c d a b sigma d a phi. Okay. Now, there's more to do. So d slash phi is minus box phi plus 2 sigma AB. There's a sigma DA floating around here. D. R, C, D, A, D, and whatever matrix that all is acting on psi. Now we've got two sigmas again. And we know, well, we've written right here what two sigmas do in whichever form we like. But here's something that makes it easier. The product of two sigmas is a product of four gamma matrices. And a product of four gamma matrices can only take a certain form. Let me write it for you. This is good practice with gamma matrices, which we're going to be doing coming up. So I don't regret the advice in the least. What's the annoying phrase they say these days? It's all good. So I just pause for questions. Does everybody everybody get it? Yeah. Okay. We need sigma, what is it, A, B, D, C. Tell you what, let's write this, let's bring the C up, and, oh, I should do that, you just need to photograph that. I'll do it. So what we're interested in is twice sigma A, B, sigma C, D, R. Now what do I have to do with indices to make that true? I raise the C and I flip a CD on the sigma. So we'll get a minus and then this is CDAD. That's the thing we're interested in. So What we need is sigma AB, sigma CD. And what I claim is, okay, remember the basis for gamma matrices. We can write, you know, every product of gamma matrices can be written as a linear combination of the identity, the four gammas, the sigmas, gamma 5, gamma A, and gamma 5. Because those form a complete basis for a 4x4 matrix. So, four gammas, all right, if there are four different gammas, then it's got to be an epsilon ABCD with a gamma 5 and some coefficient. That's the only thing we can get. Remember, this is a commutator of a bunch of gammas. So this is essentially just a product of four gamma matrices. Gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, and then a permutation of that. If all four are different, then since they all anti-commute, it's anti-symmetric in all four of those indices. So for the case where A and B are not equal to C or D, it has to be a totally anti-symmetric thing. And it'll be proportional to gamma 5, because that's the product of gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. Or, if some one pair of these indices are the same, then you have a it'll square to 1, plus or minus 1. And so you're going to be left with two that are different. The different ones anti-symmetrizing give you a sigma. The ones that are the same are something proportional to a Minkowski metric. The whole thing is Lorentz invariant. So we can only have, if A is equal to C, we'll have sigma BD and appropriate anti-symmetrizations here. I think there may be like six terms. We could have, let's see, eta AB sigma CD if we interchange BC. We could have, what's going to happen? I'm not sure if it's plus or minus here, but eta AB sigma, I think you get minuses here. You can check what the symmetry has to be. So if A equals D, we'll have a term like this with a sigma BC. Then, if we interchange A and B, we can have an eta BC sigma AD. And now we can shift the A and the B. So we have BC. We have the A, but we need to check BD, so we could have an A to BD sigma AD. And, alright, that's B with everything. Then we could have C, what is it? A CD. So, yeah, if we take this one and interchange AC, we'll have a plus A to CD sigma BA. I'm hoping I think I got the signs right there. But there's a unique choice of the signs that this could be, just based on the symmetry of these gammas, the anti-coming commutativity of the gammas.
This term has, you're missing the C. There's two B's?
Ah!
Which one is that? I don't know.
Well, if I do it. I wanted, let's see. Where was I? Okay, I interchange C and A. And now I'm interchanging the C and the D. So I guess about that. Two interchanges. Yeah. Only other possibility, things like A equals C and B equals C. And what happens there is that, all right, what I've been using is this is anti-symmetric on AB, this is anti-symmetric on CD, so I'm just imposing that symmetry. But the only other thing I can get is, let's not use gamma, what's the 90 degrees better? Lambda. These are just some combinatory facts. Then we have an identity matrix with some metrics, and the metrics would have to be A, C, B, D, or with the opposite sign, A, D, B, C. So it has to take this form, just from the way, you know, at each point you can take symmetric and anti-symmetric combinations of the gamma matrices, and it'll work out like that. If we didn't have, you know, A, B, Now, I'm doing two different things at once. If we impose the A, B, C, D, it kills that term and that term. So we don't actually need those two terms. This was the expansion of the whole thing. If we just had four gammas, right, we would have that. Since we know A is not equal to B and C is not equal to D, those two will automatically drop out. This is only non-zero if A is equal to B. So that term is not here. And then this term, I've taken that into account. If, you know, if we had gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D, then it's possible that A would equal B, and you'd have some more terms here as well. But given what we already know about these, this is all you can get. And now, I went through this in the appendices one. You'll find these calculations written out. But if I multiply by gamma 5 and take the trace, I'll get this coefficient. Right? So I have to multiply gamma 5 here, take the trace of this. Gamma 5 will square to 1, so I get 4 when I take the trace. And working out that trace of 8 gamma matrices, which isn't all that hard to do actually, I find what alpha is. If I multiply by sigma both sides and take a trace, right, sigma is orthogonal to gamma 5, like gamma 5 is orthogonal to sigma. You know, trace of all these things is 0. So I'm just multiplying by gamma 5 or sigma or 1 and taking a trace, I can find those coefficients. We don't need to do it. For at least two of those. The only coefficient we actually need is this one. And that's just the trace of two polys, which kind of forgive us is, and maybe let's not work that out today, but let me tell you what happens here. If you're willing to go slow on this and believe that this really must be the form of a product of sigmas, look what happens when we put it on a curvature. What's epsilon ABCD on RCDAB? You're beyond the identity. Symmetries of the Riemann tensor. What are the symmetries of the Riemann tensor?
It's symmetric.
Let me remind you. I've already them all. A, B, C, D is minus R. So it's anti-symmetric on the first pair. It's anti-symmetric on the second pair, DC. So if I interchange those or interchange those, it's symmetric under interchange of the pairs, like this. And if I anti-symmetrize, in fact, any three indices, the those are the symmetries of the Riemann.
That's automatically zero then?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this epsilon is going to anti-symmetrize all four.
Right. So that the first one's gone. So, yeah.
So that term is going to go away. What happens here? Okay, here, every term we've got an eta. And an eta on this, well, an eta CD would just be zero, because those are anti-symmetric. But there are some traces. If we have an eta AC, like here, we're going to get a Ricci tensor. And that Ricci tensor is going to be RDB, contracted with sigma BD. What happens? Anti-symmetric, Ricci is symmetric.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Because those all go away.
Right.
You know, they're either zero right off the bat or they turn into zero because of that symmetry. So the only one that survives is this. And what is that contracted on here? Well, we've got an AC that gives us a Ricci DD, which contracts to a Ricci scalar. And the AD gives us a minus Ricci contracted DC. And we get minus a Ricci scalar, we get two Ricci scalars. So this thing is minus 2 times 2 lambda Ricci scalar. Bullshit. It really boils down. Once you know that general.
So what's the lambda then? What's the lambda?
It's this coefficient. It's like 2 or 4 or something.
Oh, okay.
I forget what it was. But taking the trace of this, you can find it.
Okay.
You get the trace gives you 4 here. So you take the trace of 4 gamma, and you'll have it. Well, wait a minute. We know what that is. Trace of 4 gamma. Yeah, the trace of gamma A, gamma B, gamma C, gamma D for arbitrary gammas is, let's see, you get 4 eta A, B, eta C, D minus 4 eta A, C, eta B, D. I've done this more than once. 4 eta A, D, eta B, D. That's what it is. And so if I have A not equal to B and C not equal to D, A not equal to B, C not equal to D kills this one. The other two are okay. So the trace, are you okay here?
Yeah, the middle part, yeah.
So trace sigma A, B, sigma C, D has got to be 4 eta A, B, eta B, C minus eta A, C, eta B, D is equal to 4 lambda times eta A, C, eta B, D minus eta A, B, eta C, C. We get a minus sign, so lambda is a minus 1. So it wasn't 2 in particular. And that may be right. So, conclude. D slash psi is equal to minus Bach psi minus that 2 times 2 times minus 1 times R times psi. So what we get is somewhere the overall coefficients are wrong because each of these sigmas has that 1/8 factor. So we've got 1/8 squared over here. And let me see. I bet it came in somewhere else too. I'm not sure. This should be plus a quarter. and I've worked a bit on those signs, so I think that's probably right. So here's so what we get is all right, since this is m squared is phi, for the sake of phi, that's probably minus m squared is phi. What we get is box phi minus m squared phi minus 1/4 r phi equals 0. That turns out to be what you get when you square the Dirac equation in curved space. And of course, the flat space limit, r goes to 0, so you recover the original Dirac equation. So what I'd like to claim is that this is the right way to think of a scalar wave equation, too. That instead of just writing the usual Klein-Gordon equation in curvilinear coordinates, which you can do. I mean, it's a perfectly valid wave equation, but what I think is that somehow the right scalar wave equation ought to be this one. That's what the Dirac equation squares to. So if we make that supposition, then the action for a scalar field that leads to this field equation is Dirac's large number action with the pi squared r term instead of Einstein's number. And it's scale invariant. Well, it feels like it's complete lecture. It all ties together in kind of a nice way. Right. That's why people go to these curvature squared actions. There's a lot of literature out there, most of it by Philip Mannheim and about which a lot of people are very skeptical, but looking at what is commonly called conformal gravity. The Weyl curvature squares is the action. Right? It's what you get when you do the auxiliary gauging. I've always called it the auxiliary gauging of the conformal group, as opposed to the biconformal gauging of the conformal group. It's a perfectly good gauge theory of the conformal group. The most frequent, I consider an error in the literature, is that people treat it as a fourth order theory, right? The curvature tensor and the trace was part of the curvature tensor, the Weyl curvature, depend on second derivatives of the metric. So if you just take c squared and vary the metric, you get fourth order differential equations. I don't believe that's the correct way to do it. What I think you should do is a Palatini variation, where you vary every gauge field of the conformal group. And when you do that, you find that it's just general relativity plus scale invariance, plus dilatation. And that's much more sensible. Some interesting things have been shown with the other theory treated as a fourth order theory, but really, like, for example, if Gauss free, people worry with the fourth order theory that you would get Gauss. There's an argument that you don't, but then I think they say you lose unitarity or something. But if you treat it as a gauge theory and you vary all of the connection forms, otherwise you're restricting yourself arbitrarily to some subspace of the whole field space, then it's very much like general relativity. We'll finish working that out in the next one. So, welcome back. Let's see. I don't know. Is there a distance field theory? Put that off till Wednesday. I was going to remind you about Brock and Ketch and stuff, and Heisenberg representation and things like that. So we can start that on Wednesday.
Maybe the grad
school
before they close, I think. Oh, 4:30.
Oh, go.
Okay.
Fine.
I think
I'm
grad school.
Okay. So that's 20 for the first half.
Okay.
I'll stay and answer questions. Yeah.
We'll go.
So alpha and beta were never in any way restricted.
They're uniquely determined. They're just, there are things like four factors or something. There are some combinatoric factors. We could find them the same way we found lambda. We showed that lambda is minus one. We could also have taken certain traces to find alpha and beta.
But they are non-zero, and the rest of the term is what kills them.
That's right. Yeah, they're non-zero. Yeah, if you want to see, I have worked them all out. Maybe I could make a little PDF of that and send it around if you want to see it. It's not too hard to compute this stuff. But you do need, to take the traces, you need to figure out what the product of A gamma matrix is. Keep that as a homework.
I work in the specification view.
How'd you
guess?
That's too big.
Yeah. Well, thankfully it comes in 5 little pieces, so once I get it back to the office.
I loved it when they came out with the little one.
I have the big one still at home.
Yeah.
It's a pain.
If you want to work on the big one, I can give you one. That's
all right.
Yeah.
Good.
I read for who's the instructor one?
John.
Okay.
Who's teaching the other? The fall one.
Shane's one.
Shane. Okay.
Shane, right.
Well, he'll just do that.
Right.
And then Richard is teaching the first semester algebra
band. I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's fun in its own way, but I'm glad to be back to this thing. Remember all those, quick derivations.
I'll be
in touch.
Send you an email
about
maybe trying to meet later
on the
week.
You bet. Yeah.
So we'll figure out that schedule.
Yeah. In 10 minutes, I have a question. Okay.
Sure.
I try to use D. Remember, I think you sent you a file. Okay.
Yeah.
I try to use D with what do I call it? With U1, the U1 covariant derivative.
Uh huh.
And I contacted with the sigmas, and I don't get anything scalar. Yeah. Remember, I had that matrix.
I thought your insight was right, because try it in some groups, it's easy to work out, and convince yourself that sigma term can't go away. That there really is.
Right.
Except you wanted a billion, so it does go away. I think you may leave that in the U1 case, because you're using the right covariant derivative, so you'll get an F.
Right.
You'll get an F, that's right.
Right, but the thing that I didn't get, this is a Ricci scalar. I just didn't get a scalar at all, yeah.
Well, there is no scalar linear in F.
Oh, okay. Oh.
That's the problem.
Okay, so I can't...
The trace of F is zero. It's anti-symmetric.
Right, well...
So, that term really may not occur.
Okay, so I can't...
Shall we check it? We'll use RAM.
Okay.
just see what happens. I don't think it takes too long. Can I erase or do you have a question?
Actually, let me take a map or two.
So do you use it? Have you got this?
I'll start there.
Doesn't matter where you start.
So I get the F, and then I try to compute some of these sigmas, and I try to contract it with them.
Well, let's see, but the sigmas...
So I get two, diagonal, well, block diagonal things, but it's just not scalar, so...
Yeah, it's an interesting thing to try. exactly sure what, but there is no linear scalar from from F. So that may be what does it in the end. You could be getting a sigma contracted on F. F is a two form. So
all right. Okay, I'm done on the right here.
Okay. Let's just see what happens. Where do you have to be in?
I have to leave about 5 minutes.
So our covariant derivative is d phi plus, is there an I in there or not?
Yeah, I put an I in there.
Something like this.
Yeah, that's right.
So our Dirac thing is, what are we going to have? D slash plus I A slash minus M phi. Is zero. So if we take d slash phi, that's going to be m squared phi. But what is this then? We have gamma mu, gamma nu. Then du d nu. Phi, we certainly have all that, so m squared phi is zero. And we're going to get minus 2, we're in flat space, I guess, so we can write eta. And then we get a 4 sigma u nu from the anti-commutator here with the commutator to covariant derivative. So I think we're okay there. And then this ought to give us F mu nu, maybe some constant.
Right.
So it looks like we ought to get a sigma with an F.
Right.
What on earth is that? Okay.
I was trying to figure out.
Let's see. Wait a minute. Oh, have I lost?
There should be a D mu nu. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is a minus of I. And if we just work out du, d, nu, phi, that's du of d, nu plus I, a, nu, phi, minus d, nu. So we get d, nu, d, nu, plus I, d, nu, a, nu, psi, plus I, a, nu, partial, nu, psi, plus I, a, nu, d, nu, psi, minus a, nu, a, nu, psi, covariant derivative, minus the mu nu thing. And that's going to kill this and this. There's this phi here. So, and then these two are symmetric in mu nu, so when we subtract those, will go away. So we just have this, I du a nu minus d nu a nu phi, which is f mu nu. That's up to our phi
condition.
And so this term is going to be 4 I sigma mu nu F mu nu acting on psi.
Right.
But the sigma mu nu knowing what to do with psi. So, we get something. That is what it is. It's like a little Lorentz transformation of psi added in.
I'll actually putting in matrices for sigma mu nu. I'm not sure if I was going to sit down there, because it is composed of the gammas,
there's some matrices. So
right.
The E and B fields are going to be scattered around in those matrices, acting on psi. So there's a funny thing here. We probably should have had an I here, so when you square this, you get a minus one.
Oh.
There probably should have been a sign there, because I'm pretty sure we want box minus m squared. And now minus 4i fu nu. Boy, that's not the end of it. All acting on psi equals zero. So,
yeah. Yeah, I was getting that, but I just doesn't seem like anything useful. I don't know.
So what we have is a wave equation that is coupled to, well, actually, that is still a spinner wave equation. So we haven't come up with an equation that would work for a scalar field.
Right. So it wasn't scalar anyway. I could see.
So maybe. Now, I wonder if there's a way to get a scalar field. Let's see. If you squirt it in there. So if we had box minus n.